Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Alex Henley with Nature Now. Mary Robinson couldn't make it in today, so it's all me, all alone. Our guest today by phone is Dr. Megan Anderson, a geophysicist studying the Greater Puget Sound and its fault lines. There are a lot of stories as to how much snow we got this week. It depends on where you measure, really. Ham radio operators in Jefferson County reported a foot of snow at Maristone Island, Cape George, Port Hadlock, and Irondale. One spotter suggests 20 inches came down near Eagle Mount, possibly 2 feet in Squim. Most people here are used to brief winter flurries that whiten the ground and then melt away in the afternoon. This February snow came with fierce low temperatures. Many people have registered in the low teens. The first snow of February made a sturdy base to hold the amazing pile of snow, and it is very persistent. But how much water is in a foot of snow? This depends on the weight of the snow. Soft, soggy snow holds more water. Fluffy powder holds a lot less. A general guesstimate suggests that 10 inches of snow for 1 inch of water. This depends greatly on the type of snow. In just a moment, we're going to get to the interview with Megan Anderson. But first, let's listen to that mystery sound.
I am so delighted today to welcome Dr. Megan Anderson, a geophysicist. She spent her early years in Kent, Washington, and observing the eruption of Mount St. Helens when she was young, she had an early look at the power of Earth's forces. She studied subduction processes and earthquakes in South America for her PhD. She's now based in Washington State, that's lucky for us, and tracks active faults in the Puget Sound lowlands. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks, Mary.
Well, I thought we would start with a question that I have, as I generally represent the uninformed public, and I'm uninformed a little bit about subduction. I know that in order to talk about your work with active faults, we have to start with that somehow. And I realize that I've looked at pictures and I've heard talks about it, but the process stays kind of vague to me. And I think it's because geologic processes move at such a different rate than human processes that it's hard to visualize something that big.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. Geology deals with really long time, really vast expanses of time, and really large scales of objects. And so it is hard to visualize. Here in Washington, we do have a subduction zone, and everybody kind of knows that around here, people I talk to. It's off the coast of Washington and Oregon. And it's basically a place where there are two sections of the outside edge of the earth that are coming together. And these are called plates. There's sections. And the one is the North American plate, and that's the one that we're sitting on. And the other is the Juan de Fuca plate, which is out underneath the Pacific Ocean.
Right. And so the Juan de Fuca is moving underneath the North American plate.
Right. They're moving together. And in that battle, Juan de Fuca loses, and it gets recycled down inside the earth. But when we're thinking about, well, how does that relate to what's happening in the crust and faults in the lowland, these two plates are coming together and moving towards each other, and they're just creating this great compression, compressing all of the rocks. And of course, something has to give, and sometimes it creates a fault and it creates earthquakes. And so that's one of the big forces in our area. There's also a section of the North American plate down in Oregon, like central and northern Oregon, that's very stiff, and for some reason, it's moving northward. And we don't know exactly why that is, but we've tracked it with GPS and satellite, and it is moving northward, and it is moving towards the Puget Lowland. And this creates compression and that kind of stress in a different direction. We have actually a couple different forces, and it creates really complex faulting, and that's why it's not straightforward to figure out what's going on? And that's, okay. you know, why I have a job.
Well, you wouldn't have your job if you weren't very, very well trained at this. I think this is a good place to talk about the mechanics of your studies. Say you're standing on a hillside thinking what to do, and you want to measure an active fault. What are the skills and tools that come together to make this work?
Well, for me, my major tool is called geophysics. And it's really useful around here because there is a lot of plants. There's trees, there's shrubs growing everywhere, and you can't really see the rocks underneath the surface because they're buried by all of the plant material and soils. And what geophysics does for us is it allows us to see underneath the ground surface. And that's kind of hard to understand at first, but let me give an analogy related to medical imaging. You've heard of a CAT scan.
Indeed.
If you have a problem with your brain and mm-hmm. your doctor wants to see what's going on, he puts you in a CAT scan machine, and what mm-hmm. they do is they send x-rays through your head, and they measure them not inside your head, but on the outside. How those x-rays change as they go past through your brain, you can measure that on the outside of your skull. It can create an image of the inside of your head. Geophysics works very similarly. What we're doing is we're measuring physical fields, and in our case, it's not x-rays, but maybe seismic waves created by earthquakes or gravitational magnetic fields. We're measuring them on the surface of the earth, and we're using those fields to create images of the inside of the earth. That's kind of in a general sense what we're doing.
When you get a geophysical image, how do you keep it so you can use it?
Yeah.
You have to have some form of data collection that mm-hmm. keeps what you've just seen under the earth.
Exactly. There are different kinds of geophysics, and so I think probably the best one to give it, you know, kind of set the scene for what we're doing when we're out there getting this data and trying to understand these faults is gravity. And gravity is something that, you know, we deal with every day as humans. We all know that if an object has more mass, piece of metal versus a ball of styrofoam, it's got more mass, gravity acts more greatly on it, pulls mm-hmm. it down harder, right? We all experience that.
Sure.
Well, rocks are the same. And a good example is that the rocks underneath the surface of most of the Puget Lowland area are basalt. They're much like the rocks that are being currently made in Hawaii. And those rocks
they're
volcanic in origin. They were made about 30 million years ago, but the important thing is that they're very dense. They're very heavy. Let's give an example of how gravity helps us understand faulting in a basalt. Let's say you have fracture through the earth. It's a fault, and let's call it something called a reverse fault. And that means that one side moves up, and the other side of that fracture moves down. What happens on the surface of the earth in an area that's low, like on the down drop side? It fills with water, right? Water likes to flow down into the low area. And so it carries with it sediment, like sand and clay and that sort of stuff. And that sediment settles in the low area. Well, sediment is a lot less dense than basalt. And so if we measure the gravitational field going from that upthrown side, where we have basalt at the surface, to the downthrown side, where we have sediment at the surface, we see a change in the gravitational field. Yeah, and it's really simple Newtonian physics that everybody learns if they take physics in high school.
You learn it, but
you know, the only reason that I have to have a PhD to do this is that, you know, you have to learn how to use sensitive instruments, and
sure.
you have to learn how to plan surveys to get precise enough data to tell us what we want to know.
You are using the equipment that helps you study the gravitational forces affecting what's underground. Did I get that right?
Yeah. The gravitational forces are affected by what's underground.
Okay. This brings us to what your work consists of. When I first talked with you, you mentioned the Seattle Fault, for instance, which it was very well known in this area, we thought, until recently you mentioned that nobody knew where the Seattle Fault started and where it ended, that had not been observed. But with the work that's going, not just with you, but with a number of people on a team, more is now known about the Seattle Fault, correct?
That's true. We knew about the Seattle Fault mainly along the banks of the Puget Sound, where there's rock exposed on the beaches, and there are also some really good indications from a type of data, surface data called LIDAR, and a lot of your audience probably has heard about LIDAR because it's in the news a lot.
It's being used for so many different things, including archaeology, that I think it's a familiar term, but we need to see how does LIDAR work into what we're saying about the Seattle Fault.
Exactly. Remember the example I was describing about the fault lifting up one side and down dropping the other? That makes a really distinctive surface feature if there's been movement recently. That's happened along the Seattle Fault. The last rupture was around 1,000 years ago. You can actually see in the topography from the LIDAR a nice linear, a little half-hill sort of thing going on in the data. But it doesn't extend forever. And so what the gravity data allows you to do, like let's say I was working in the area where we have LIDAR and we have geological exposure, I would go and measure gravity in a grid extending across a large area of Earth's surface. And I would figure out where is gravity high, where is gravity low. The fault is in between those highs and lows. And so with that, I can actually trace where the fault goes in the subsurface.
In spite of the fact that there's no visible noticing in the rock the way you can in some cases, right? You are then underground.
Basically visualizing what's underground.
Okay.
And with this tool, we've discovered that the Seattle Fault goes all the way over to the Olympic Mountain.
What?
Actually west of Hood Canal, all the way over there. And it goes almost all the way to right at the foot of the Cascade Mount. So it's pretty long and extends across the entire urban area of Seattle through Bremerton and all the way over to the Olympics.
This doesn't mean that if something happened on that fault, it would happen uniformly the whole length of the fault. It might not, right?
Absolutely. Faults, when they move, they don't just all move in the same, the whole surface doesn't move in a uniform fashion. One area could move and another not, and then maybe if there's an earthquake, you know, another 1,000 years in the future, a different part of the fault could move.
What we read identifies the Seattle Fault as if it is a unity, and what you're learning is how to see it as part of a whole ecology of faults, connected in one way and another. I'm still thinking about this. Instead of one fault that looks like a lightning strike, you are finding interwoven patterns.
Exactly. And I love that analogy of the ecology of faults. I think it's very true. As we were just talking about, movement on one part of a fault may affect what movement happens on another part later. And movement on one fault can affect another fault that it's connected to.
Which might not even be the first most obvious thing.
Exactly. And so we call that actually the technical term is a fault system, which is kind of like an ecosystem, right? Think about it like interwoven patterns, and each of those pieces is moving independent of the others, and that creates the fault movement. And of course, if you take one piece of that whole puzzle and you try to move it on its own, it's going to affect everything in the surrounding area.
I've been thinking of looking at it as if it were a very large, extremely fractured ceramic dish, where every piece of it is still there, but none of them are still connected.
Exactly. And if you took one of those pieces of the dish and say along one edge you tried to move it away from its neighbor,
they
what
would move.
That do on the other edges? You'd get maybe a kind of side-to-side motion on a couple other edges. You kind of create a space problem on the other side. And so that's exactly what's happening in the crust of the Earth.
So I'm wondering which areas are being most currently studied. Your information says you're working in the Puget Lowlands. Essentially then adding to our knowledge of what's going on in this big fractured place. And
exactly.
So two things. What has changed in old maps of faults? I know that people have taken some things for granted for a long time along and about the Hood Canal and such. You've added some differences from what you've studied.
Exactly. The teams and different researchers I've worked with over the years, we've really changed the map of faults in the Puget Lowland a lot in the last 10 years. You mentioned Hood Canal. Scientists suspected it was a fault because it's very linear. It forms kind of a line, not wiggly. The idea or hypothesis people had was that its shape was controlled by a fault existing in the subsurface underneath it. But now we know that the Seattle Fault actually extends across the canal, and it connects with faults that we figured out exist actually up in the foothills of the Olympic Mountain. The Hood Canal is probably not a fault. The fault is actually uphill from the canal.
So it's not. It's as if the canal is not defined by a nice piece of faulty string that runs from one end of it to the other. Right?
It was probably made by something that happened with the glaciers. It can make linear patterns in the topography, too.
And I read somewhere that actually it was supposed to be called Hood Channel, but there was a mistake in copying a map. And it became Hood Canal, which it is not a canal at all. So, and now we know it's not the site of a lengthy fault. And currently, where are you specifically working? I know right now you're working to bring together a lot of the data that numbers of people have gathered.
I have been. And one of kind of the areas, though, that are actively being researched, the places where doing geophysics and people are looking at LIDAR and other kinds of data, doing geological mapping, is along a fault called the Sadie Creek Fault, which is near Port Angeles.
And it's on a sea edge. I mean, it's on the edge of water, right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's kind of just up from the Straits of Juan de Fuca. And researchers at Western Washington University are working with their students on that project. Then there is U.S. Geological Survey people working on a fault system called the Canyon River Frigid Creek Fault System, which is along the southern edge of the Olympic Mountains. And of course, those two regions are trying to figure out, okay, how then do those faults connect up with the Seattle Fault, the faults that are up in the Olympic Mountains that I was talking about? How does that connect in? So in the last 10 years, we've been focused a lot on the Puget Lowland, and now we're kind of stepping out and saying, okay, where does this extend a little further afield? I'm working down near Centralia on a fault called the Doty Fault. It's a big fault that kind of trends east to west, very similar to the Seattle Fault. Mm-hmm. But we don't know anything about its history. We don't know if it's currently active. We don't know where it extends to, very similar to what we used to have for the Seattle Fault. We don't know if it goes close to towns or cities or other infrastructure that might be impacted if it experiences an earthquake. So that's the area I'm working in. So again, we're kind of expanding west and south and
you're essentially
east and north.
Poking your skills into the unknown.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fascinating.
And I think it's what's really amazing about doing geology and studying faults out here, because there are so many active faults. We don't understand a lot of them very well yet, and there's even faults that we have yet to discover that we don't even know are there. And so it's very much a frontier of science.
That's pretty exciting. You don't have to have a Conestoga wagon, but you do have to have a lot of equipment in order to explore this frontier.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that this is a rather huge collaborative effort. No one person could begin to be in all the places that are being looked at and getting the work together. So you said there are at least 6 or 7 people, and you mentioned Western Washington being involved. Someone has to assign the locations. How does somebody say, okay, well, now we know the Seattle Fault runs up toward the Olympic Mountains. Now what we need to do is da-da-da-da.
That's a really great question. I would say it's kind of, the word I use is a grassroots process.
Okay.
Where researchers learn who else is working in the area, and you reach out to those people and you go meet with them, find out, what are you doing? What are you working on? Problems are left to be solved. I was noticing this thing over here. You know, is that something that we should look into? Of course, we often will attend meetings, both regionally and nationally, where we can connect with other people who are working in the same area and trade data and results, but also talk about where should we go in the future? What still needs to be studied? That's kind of how we move forward.
Sure. And that, in effect, that makes it an area where you've got more than one mind considering what needs to happen next.
Yeah, it's really essential, actually, that a lot of people get together and, you know, put their ideas to work, because everybody has a different perspective and brings, you know, a different way of looking at things. And so it's really valuable to have all those people working together to figure out what's the most important problem next.
You have told us a little bit about how you work and where you're working. You are not obviously working on an oil production facility or studying fracking by making it work. How did you happen to select your specialty?
That's something that was really a big important step in my life. I had lots of friends in graduate school who studied seismology or earthquakes like I did. There's a lot of employment working in the oil and gas sector. A lot of them went to work for an oil company after they graduated, but I found I was really not excited by the goal goals for the projects that the oil companies were working on. I wasn't excited about extracting oil as being the goal. I really wanted to do something to help communities directly. Earthquake hazards is, and studying that and trying to understand faults and then how to translate their hazards to the public is the area that I was drawn to as a way that I could do science but also get to help my community at the same time.
Well, I would say that is definitely happening. What I'd like to do, since our time is limited by reality here, is get back together with you again in about a year and see what's evolved with the data, what's happened, what have you learned that we didn't talk about today. I'd very much enjoy doing that because I feel more connected with the world under our feet.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love to come back and give an update as to what people are discovering in
sure.
some of these specific studies that
yeah.
are new and what we're also thinking of next.
Right, and until you finish the current batch of data, you can't leap into the next. Or this is not a project that has an endpoint. I mean, I'm seeing it as a project that puts bits into the puzzle but doesn't put the whole thing together because that's a much longer study.
Exactly. When we think about the very start of earthquake seismology, it was 1906, the big
wow.
earthquake
well,
that happened
yeah.
in San Francisco. They have had, since that time, over 100 years to do these kinds of studies in California. We started really kind of hitting the earthquake creating faults up in the Pacific Northwest. We started hitting those problems hard, probably around starting in 1995. We've got a long way to go, but as they've shown in California, you just keep working at it and adding more and more data and studies, and you start seeing more and more of these fault networks extending out through space.
Thank you so much for being here. This has been wonderfully informative and lively, and I'm just looking forward to more when we can get back together. So thank you so much, Megan.
It was great talking to you.
Okay, bye.
Well, thank you, Mary, for that interview. Let's listen to that mystery sound again. Despite its appreciation of berries, the varied thrush seems to avoid garden fruit, which robins devour. Both male and female varied thrush have a distinct V shape on the chest, dark brown for the males, lighter brown for the females. Their song, with its separate notes, is reminiscent of someone practicing an oboe. A lot of events got canceled this week because of the snow. One particular event that I was very much looking forward to was the open house with Eleonora the Octopus at the Marine Science Center. I bet she still got fed. Though, coming up on February 16th, from 10 o'clock to 11:30 at the Marine Science Center, there's a new volunteer training at the Aquarium Classroom. The Jamestown Skalum Tribe Speaker Series, Historical Relationships Between Skalum People and the Cedar. That is February 15th at 5:30 p.m. at the Dungeness Audubon Center. That's it for Nature Now. Thanks to Mary Robson for all of her research and incredible interview skills, which I do not have, and her insatiable appetite for information. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic, live, and eclectic reports on the natural world. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Podcasts are also available on the website at kptz.org. The song this week is Shango, Day After Day.
After day, more people come to LA. Shh, don't you tell anybody, the whole place slipping away.
Where can we go when there's no San Francisco? Shh, better get ready to tie up the boat in Idaho.
Do you know the swim? You better learn quick, Jim.
Those who don't know the swim better sing the hymn.
Tuna at the bowl, fine fillet of mutso.
Ooh, what can you do with a bushel of wet gold?
Day after day, more people come to LA.
Shh, don't you tell anybody, the whole place shaking away.